Welcome to our podcast. My name is Keely Severson, and I am here with Eric Johnson and Alicia Swamy, and together we are exposing mold. Today we are speaking with Lindsay from Great Plains Laboratory.
This podcast is brought to you by Michael Rubino, the mold medic, and All American Restoration, the first and only mold remediation company in the country specializing in remediating mold for people with underlying health conditions or mold sensitivities. They've quickly become the most recommended remediation company from doctors and mold inspectors nationwide. Check out our show notes to pick up your copy of Michael Rubino's book, The Mold Medic, an expert guide on mold remediation, or visit allamericanrestoration.com to get your home assessed and get your health back on track today.
Welcome, Lindsay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you were talking about being in private practice and working with hospitals prior to you joining Great Plains Laboratory. I'm interested, what healthcare field were you practicing in private practice?
So I'm a dietitian. And so I originally started out working at a county hospital, working with rehab patients and doing some metabolics and genetics. And then I moved around a lot and changed into different fields of like pediatrics, NICU, outpatient GI clinics. And then I started getting into more private practice and consulting with other healthcare professionals like physicians and working in their clinics and helping their patients with them. And we would do therapies together. And I started working more in integrative and functional medicine in that aspect. And then things got really, really busy. So I took a step back and just consulting with the laboratory because it was a lot more flexible and not as time consuming.
What does it look like to be consulting with the laboratory? Like what kind of role is that? Is that a support role for the laboratory?
So what I do is I talk to providers that are running the tests and help them interpret the data and help bring a bigger picture versus maybe give them up-to-date information on what's going on in the literature for the metabolites, or just teach them how to use the testing.
Mm-hmm. With your dietitian background, do you tend to feel like a lot of mycotoxins that are found in people's mycotoxin testing are specifically from food?
I don't. So there's a little piece to food when it comes to mycotoxins, but depending on where you are, mycotoxins are not as big of an issue with food. And that's because the USDA and the FDA are monitoring it to a degree. And it's our food systems are fairly safe overall. But that's not the case. Like, say you go to Africa, where it's more about food availability and quality because of just the structure of everything. And there, yes, you probably would want to be more cautious of mycotoxins in the food. But here in the U.S., it's not as big of an issue. I would say the main reason why people are getting sick from mycotoxins is from an environmental perspective.
Lindsay, I wanted to follow up on that great, great question that Keely had just asked you. And you had mentioned it was from environmental exposure. Do you mean through inhalational route? Like people are directly breathing in this stuff? Or what do you mean by environmental, I guess, exposure?
Yeah, sorry. So meaning that it's coming from their like enclosed environment, whether it be their home, their car. And some aspects, like if they were working in an environment that had water damaged buildings, or if they're working in, like I just had the other day, grow houses, individuals who are working in these enclosed spaces, and they can get it through inhalation, they can get it through skin contact. Those tend to be the two bigger ones versus consuming it on the food. You're going to get some, but it's not to the degree that you would get in an enclosed space.
It's not enough to cause a disability like we're seeing in some of the mold injured people. And I'm so happy to hear you say that, because when we look at some of these mycotoxin articles that are written by doctors, it seems as if they're trying to almost minimize the exposure from an indoor contamination source and blame it on food. almost to minimize the role of mold growing indoors. So I find what I tend to think of is almost propaganda type articles when a medical doctor will say the urine mycotoxin testing is invalid because that's all coming from just your food supply. And I feel like that's such a misleading thing to tell people if they're living inside water damaged spaces, because most people don't associate water damage with hidden mold somewhere in their walls. So often they won't know that it's exposed. And that's where the role of the test comes in to show them that they're exposed and that this could be making them sick when they might not realize that. Do you find that people ever have test results where things aren't showing, even though people are sick?
Sure. Yeah. Sometimes you will see that. They'll be like, I tested my home for mold and the mycotoxins aren't showing. And they may be being exposed to other mycotoxins that maybe we're not measuring. We're measuring the 11 most common in the medical literature that have a lot of evidence behind them. But there's over 300 different mycotoxins to date that have been identified, probably more out there. And so we can't, for pricing purposes, we can't look at them all. So there's that aspect. And then beyond the mycotoxins from mold, there's other things that molds are producing just as a defense mechanism and a survival perspective that can make us sick as well. So they can produce antibiotics. Then there's all these bacteria that are also involved with mold growth in the home. So there's a lot of different perspectives going on there. And I think mycotoxins are just a piece of the picture.
What do you think that are other pieces of the picture when you say mycotoxins are just one piece?
The different bacteria that grow within a moldy environment, the other molds that are growing too, and then the decaying of the wood. And I think those are like some of the things that are starting to come out in the literature too with water damage buildings.
I feel like maybe I missed something and I'm a little confused. I guess I thought you were saying in the mycotoxin testing, like mycotoxins are just part of the health picture. And when I hear you say decaying wood, I don't feel like you would be associating that with a health picture.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be confusing. So I was just saying that when you're dealing with mold in the environment, you're having mycotoxins. And that's a big part of toxicity that's happening to an individual when they're living in the moldy environment. But there's also other things that can be contributing to their sickness related to the mold. So there's bacteria that can live together with the mold that can make people sick. There's other byproducts that the mold is producing that can make them sick beyond mycotoxins.
The spores. You mean other aspects of a damp environment that contribute to the overall declining health picture?
Correct.
Yeah, a lot of people do have secondary infections when their immune systems become weakened by an immunosuppressant mold or mycotoxin, and then will have like recurrent strep or recurrent UTIs or something along that line where it's like a secondary bacteria infection of some sort. And then people tend to think that's like the primary thing, that bacteria infection was what caused the illness.
Great Plains has some rockin' panels. You guys are really on it with what you offer. And I was going through each panel one by one, and I know some of the panels are like a series of other panels, I guess, if I'm making any sense here. Like autism has like XYZ panel, fibromyalgia has XYZ panel. And I'm curious why a mycotoxin panel isn't included in those. Because actually, Andrew Campbell, Dr. Andrew Campbell, he's just a pioneer in mold, and he is so awesome. And he was actually doing some research and has done some research on the connection to autism and mold exposure.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if that's something that you guys actually do include, and maybe I just didn't find it on the website with those different panels.
You know, I'm looking at it, and it should be on there. When they're running autism spectrum panels, and I'm seeing them, show up. So it may just not be on the website. I'll have to talk to marketing about that.
Yeah, I figured you guys would have it, but I don't know. Yeah. My poor navigational skills didn't lead me to the answer, but it's just really interesting. And just anyways, to spring off that, if that's just a technical error or whatever, but how often do you see mycotoxins in the urine of patients with chronic illness like fibromyalgia or autism. I don't know if you guys have a panel for MS, but just stuff like that and your observation.
Definitely see it. Really interesting because then they'll take an organic acid test alongside the mycotoxin. But you can see mycotoxins being extremely elevated. And I'm not saying just like the average mycotoxin elevations that we're typically seeing for people who are suspicious of mycotoxin exposure. I'm seeing extreme elevations. So for example, ochratoxin A, on average, you might see somewhere between 15 and 30. For children with autism, I've seen 100, 200, 300, then get pretty high. And then when you look at it together with the organic acid test, sometimes you can actually see metabolites of aspergillus in their urine as well. That's markers 2, 4, and 5 on the organic acid test. And I think it's Dr. Sydney Baker, him and Dr. Shaw did a case study where they had a little boy. Stop me if you've heard this already.
No, we haven't heard this. Yeah, we'd love to hear the story.
Okay, so this is a case study of a young boy with autism, barely functioning. And what they found was that he had these aspergillus markers elevated in the organic acid test. And so they put him on Sporinox. And over a series of a few months, he improved so dramatically, he basically was deemed that he did not have autism anymore. And it was in correlation with the lowered aspergillus markers.
Wow, that is incredible. And it's incredible that you say that they have these elevated markers. I'm curious, in your panel, are you seeing an elevation of exposure to T2 mycotoxins, the trichothecin producers like Stachybotrys, Fusarium, Ketomium, in these patients that are chronically ill?
Not all the time. I wouldn't say that that's consistent. What I would say consistently is that they do often have higher elevations of some of the mycotoxins, but I haven't been able to specifically say it's the trichothecin.
Wow, that's incredible. Eric has such a long history, and I don't know if you know his background. He was the prototype for chronic fatigue syndrome and connected Stachybotrys to that syndrome. And I'd love to give him center stage here to just ask you questions and maybe provide more information to you and see just what you see also in the chronic fatigue section of patients that you also serve as well.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the Leitao mystery illness, the Center for Disease Control, the researchers, everybody who tried to analyze this illness were completely ignorant of the possibility that toxic mold might be a factor.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were specifically asked to look into it and refused. And this refusal was so pervasive and consistent that when the chronic fatigue syndrome definition was created, these clues were entirely left out of the definition, and nobody ever came back to find out that the original chronic fatigue syndrome outbreak, the cohort, was in direct proximity to Stachybotrys.
Yeah. And it makes sense because Stachybotrys produces these trichothecin. And if you look at their structure, you know, they're amphiphilic. So they can get in and out of the cellular membrane very easily. And once they get into those cells and they can get the mitochondria and start affecting the enzymes from that perspective and reducing the ATP production, which is the energy currency of this cell, then it makes perfect sense why it could certainly be a huge player. And that's just one little part of it, right? There's so many other aspects in how toxic it can be, affecting cellular division.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the Stachybotrys mold in particular, is that at the 2019 Mold Congress, Dr. Qin Yang outlined that he believes that the major effect of Stachybotrys might not be the neuroinflammatory compounds at all, that it's the dolabellanes and atrenones, which are purely immune suppressive, and the evil twin, Stachybotrys chlorohalonata, which is indistinguishable from Stachybotrys chartarum, the only way they can tell is by PCR, that this might actually be a factor in a lot of homes where Stachybotrys appears to be harmless, when in reality, it's just putting out the atrenones exclusively without the warning signs of the neuroinflammatory ones that would tell you to get out and shutting off people's immune systems.
Mm-hmm.
So So do you test for the dolabellines and atrenomes?
The ones we test for are the Inatin B and the Rugrin A. Those are the Stachybotrys.
Yeah, so like the Stachylysins and Satratoxin G and all the ones that would induce some kind of neurological warning response. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the atrenomes, they don't have any warning. They just shut off cell division, and you basically have no ability to regenerate, no immune system, and no warning to let you know about it.
Mm-hmm. It's scary. And some of the sickest patients I come across will have those elevated. And it's anytime I see those on the microtalk, it's a huge red flag. Huge. And I don't think, at least thankfully, the physicians that we're working with in the laboratory and other healthcare practitioners, they take it very seriously.
Back in the day when there were no mold doctors, no mold tests, no awareness of toxic mold at all, we were pretty much left to our own devices. Mm-hmm. So we had to rely on our senses. And I started taking people on what I call the chronic fatigue syndrome history mold tour. And we would go to buildings where Stachybotrys had been identified. And sure enough, people diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome would start screaming. And the peculiar thing is, these are all buildings where specialists, experts, indoor air quality testers were unable to find significant amounts of mold.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew immediately that their testing had not evolved to the point where they could reliably correlate their results, whatever they were detecting, to our symptoms. And all the way through the development of mold testing, through Anderson air sampling, through PCR, through the ERMI, HERTSMI, all this, mm-hmm. they have never successfully brought up their ability to detect mold to anything remotely what we can sense. So from that point of view, I always considered mold testing to be completely unreliable. And as you say, it can be suggestive, but when it comes right down to it, you really have to rely on your senses.
Yeah, it is a tricky game, testing for mold in a building. And I see that time and time again where people will say, like, we did the ERMI, we did the air quality testing, we had a mold inspector come out and nobody found anything. And maybe the ERMI picked up something, but it wasn't to the extent that they found later when they opened up a wall and were able to see all inside of the massive amount of mold. And something that I've noticed with the patient population is once they are out of the environment and they have somewhat healed from the exposure, it's like finding mold is their new superpower. They can immediately pick it up as soon as it's anywhere in their environment. Their immune system is so sensitized to it. So,
yeah, that's exactly how it was for the original CFS cohort. In fact, I don't know if you're familiar with the history of chronic fatigue syndrome, but it was when a terrible flu struck the town of Incline Village, Nevada. And we noticed that people who were in the sick buildings weren't recovering from this flu. Everybody else did, but not the people in sick buildings. So naturally, I wanted to find out what was in the sick buildings. And it didn't take long to find out that the common denominator was Stachybotrys. There could be other molds, other bacteria, other chemicals, many other factors, but the common denominator was Stachybotrys. In those buildings, I met people who, just as you say, once they were exposed to this, they were permanently sensitized. They could detect it no matter where they went.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't true of the other molds. Like, we breathe aspergillus and penicillium all day long, but we aren't sensitized to that. But we are to Stachybotrys. And in this poster behind me, it talks about a similar situation to the original chronic fatigue syndrome outbreak, a hospital in Quebec where all the healthcare workers got sick and they found Stachybotrys. And even after removal from the hospital, they did not recover. So this clear pattern that Stachybotrys was something special emerged right from the start. And yet doctors, rather than attaching importance to this, as they developed more and more tests for more and more molds and more toxins, they seem to have drifted away from how unique and special this particular Stachybotrys mold really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I wish there was more emphasis on that. Now, I will have to say, whenever I speak with a mold inspector, anytime they find Stachybotrys, they take it very, very seriously. So I'm hopeful that maybe that's changing, that when people find Stachy, they realize how dangerous it really is.
Yeah, in the early days of mold testing, back when Anderson air sampling was the standard, they would find all kinds of molds, and an experienced tester would find one single spore of Stachybotrys and say, run for your life.
Yes.
So they knew through sheer experience that there was something special about this. But instead of attaching more importance to this, what happened over time is as they developed a concept that we can correlate amounts of mold in your urine to the levels of the toxins that we can measure must surely correspond to your illness, that distinction actually disappeared. And now you've got so much level of gliotoxin, or you've got ochratoxin, or you've got this or that or the other thing. And they don't frame Stachybotrys in the one spore that run for your life category anymore.
Yeah. And something else I'm seeing on the testing is you may see a little bit come out. And then as you start supporting the body's elimination processes and the liver, you'll start to see a lot more come out. And the levels get much higher and the patient starts to feel better. And if you look at even just like the half-life of these mycotoxins coming from Stachy, the trichocysteine, they are quite high. Like I think with Verrucan A, it's 30 to 35 days, just as a half-life. So that means multiply that by 5 times to get around 97% gone, but almost 6 months.
One of the things that we're exploring is that once the T cells received a program for this specific toxin, the memory cells keep that program upregulated, even with very minute exposures, so that the immunological response itself, the Th17 cells, are refreshed and reprogramming for an elevated cytokine response, even after the toxins themselves may have left the body.
Mm-hmm. And it's thought-provoking with all of this new MCAS and histamine intolerance coming out. Have you read any?
Yeah. So what's the driving force? Is it the actual presence of the toxin, or is it the immunological programming?
Yeah. And that's a great question, because when they come and they've had a history of mold exposure and they run a mycotox test, and maybe that mold exposure was 15 years ago, there's no mycotoxins really to speak of showing up in the urine, but they are very sick and they're very sensitive. What do you say?
I say that the evidence is very suggestive that it's a programmed immune response that lingers long after you may have detoxified pretty much anything that was in your system. So that's what we're trying to get top researchers to look into. But they actually use the evidence of these test results against us to say, because we don't detect this, there's nothing to look into. And if we do detect it, that just means that you need to detox until we don't detect it anymore.
Right. Sounds awfully similar to some chemicals, doesn't it? Like, oh, we're not seeing it in your urine anymore, so it's not affecting you, or it didn't affect you. You may have eliminated the toxins, but the repercussions of it aren't gone.
Yeah, it's really interesting that the hypersensitization response is so unfamiliar to doctors that they seem to be looking for excuses not to look into it.
Yeah. I would say the physicians that use DTL, I feel, are on it. They have some understanding and they acknowledge that. So even if those toxins aren't there, they may have contributed at one time. And I appreciate that population.
Keely Severson is passionate and committed to exposing the truth about toxic mold and its effects on the human body. Many mold-injured people are often misdiagnosed with autoimmune conditions, nerve damage, mental illnesses, and other chronic health conditions due to the lack of knowledge about water damage and toxic mold growing in their homes. The crippling effects of toxic mold on the body has destroyed many lives. Been there, done that. When she became a healthcare provider specializing in acupuncture and herbal medicine, it was only then that she truly began to understand the connection between her health and the environment that she was living in. 3 years after becoming a licensed care provider, she became incredibly ill. She was suffering from kidney failure, reoccurring UTIs, and various negative mental health symptoms. When she learned that her family had been dwelling with mold trapped under her kitchen floor, the relationship between the toxic mold factor and her health finally began to make sense. It became part of her life's mission to help educate society on the extreme effects that mold can have on the body. Her work is vital because there exists a lack of experience and acknowledgement from mainstream medical practitioners and even mold experts. She has firsthand experience dealing with mold exposure, and she makes sure to address all the signs and symptoms during every environmental screening that she performs. She's developed a line of organic herbal tinctures and formulas to help most patients reduce symptoms commonly associated with toxic mold exposures. These symptoms vary and can manifest themselves very differently from person to person. Her herbal education and experience has helped her increase awareness and recognize signs in patients that may result from their toxic environments. Keely's dedication to learning and understanding the effects of toxic mold and educating and bringing awareness to her patients and other providers keep her motivated. She knows just how devastating the untreated consequences can be on your health and the health of your families, relationships, and life outcomes. If you or someone you know may be affected by toxic mold exposure, rest assured that you and Keely will work together to find a solution. By working together to treat the symptoms and stay educated on toxic mold exposures, we can reduce the impact of this devastating phenomenon. To consult with Keely, please visit exposingmold.com/consultations. That's exposingmold.com/consultations. Book your appointment today.
Are you familiar with the growing awareness of what they call MECFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome?
No, I'm not.
The CDC, NIH, institutes, researchers all over the world are really confused about this disease entity that they're calling MECFS, which is actually a conglomeration of two different outbreaks, 1955 Royal Free Hospital outbreak in London, where a bunch of people got sick for no apparent reason and never recovered, and my outbreak of Incline Village, 1985, same exact thing, a flu-like illness went through, and a certain percentage of the population just never recovered. So in the lack of any good clues, they've been chasing viruses for all these years and completely ignoring the fact that these outbreaks occurred in sick buildings. So I've been trying to get the mold researchers to connect their paradigm with the MECFS entity so that we can get these researchers to take interest in environmental factors.
Oh, that would be wonderful. There's so much that we need to address. And I've started wondering, too, with these COVID long haulers, where do they live? What's going on there? Could mold be a piece of that picture in some instances?
Yeah, every researcher that we've talked to we've asked about this says, certainly, it's got to be a factor. Given the immunosuppressive properties of mold, it can't help but be at least a portion of what we're calling long COVID. Yeah. But so far, they're not looking into it. They're focusing completely on whatever after effects the virus would have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can be quite frustrating. And then you have the people that say, but mold everywhere. Like, well, to a degree, Aspergillus, Penicillium, but not staph.
Yeah, when I approached Dr. Mold, Dr. Vincent Marinkovich, back in the 1990s, he was the top mold expert on the West Coast. And I told him about the mold tour and how we were detecting mold where nobody else could find it. And I said I had done experiments of detecting mold behind walls And I even went so far as to seal up a sample of Stachybotrys inside a HEPA filter to see if I could still perceive it when clearly the spores and fragments should have been contained. And I could. So I told him about this experiment, and he was surprised and said that he had just heard about a housing project in Sweden where all the inhabitants were sick, but nothing could be found. And it wasn't until they broke open the walls and found Stachybotrys hidden but sealed so tightly that no spores and fragments were getting out to be detected. So I warned him, we have to tell the world that mold testing is inadequate. They're not finding it. We can't rely on these tests at this point. And we have to get researchers to look into this, warn patients to go by their symptoms. And if they believe something's behind a wall, bust open the wall and find it.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And just like with Stachy, for example, those mycotoxins are so small, but they're heavy. And so you're not going to get them in an air sample unless it's very obvious. And that's what I'm seeing a lot in the mold testing is they don't find Stachy until they actually go behind the wall, or sometimes you can pick it up in the ERMI.
The problem is that in certain circumstances, Stachybotrys appears to be acting more like a gas, like mm-hmm. a volatile that can go right through a wall, right through plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, all the tests seem to be aimed at something that's acting more like a fragment that can't possibly do that. And our reports of sensitization to something that exists, even on hard, non-porous objects, even smooth plastic or metal or ceramic, we can wash it and yet we still feel something. And it looks like it's not really a spore or fragment because it acts to our senses like a gas. And yet we are completely unable to get researchers to believe our description because they are so convinced that their testing would find anything that's there to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great discussion with Dr. Strauss about this. He said that our ability to detect Stachybotrys toxins is so limited that in order to bring it up to the level where we can find it, it has to be concentrated. But clearly, hypersensitive people can find it at levels far, far below our testing ability.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it goes right back to your point of listening to the patient. And when they're saying something is wrong, especially in their home, and going on your symptoms.
Yeah. And now we just need to get more researchers to look beyond their testing for an agent that they haven't discovered yet, or at least test methods that can find something that at this point they're completely incapable of detecting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I don't know if you've read Mold Warriors or Surviving Mold.
No, I've read a little bit of Surviving Mold, but not the Mold Warriors.
Okay, I put my story of mold at ground zero for chronic fatigue syndrome in his books in an effort to get researchers to connect the dots, come back to the origin of this syndrome, mm-hmm. and help us study this thing. And so far, not a single doctor has done so. There's been no response whatsoever. But Dr. Shoemaker and I carried on this project for nearly 20 years of trying to get researchers to come back to look into this very famous controversial syndrome. And Dr. Shoemaker took a side road here into actinomycetes. He now says that mycotoxins are less than 7% of SIRS, and the vast majority of gene activations are endotoxins and directly to substances from actinomycetes.
Hmm.
And the project to look into toxic mold, it went way on the back burner here to the point where he hasn't even mentioned it for about 3 years now. So what's going on in the actinomycetes world? Are you moving into testing for bacteria and moving away from telling people that they probably have mold illness?
I don't think so. I think we're working actually on adding more mycotoxins to the panel.
Wow.
That's good to hear, honestly, because we were afraid that mold was going to be thrown out as a problem. And I'm curious, are you seeing a lot of people utilizing Great Plains Laboratory for litigation for them to maybe go after, I don't know, whoever, their landlord, or to prove causation of their illness?
So I get a lot of calls calls from patients and practitioners that want to, I don't always get the end result, unfortunately. So I hear that they're doing it, but I don't hear the outcome. Now, I have a friend in South Florida who is an attorney that deals with real estate and litigation, and she's been involved in a few mold cases. And she says it's hard. It's very difficult to prove that it was the mold that was making this person ill. And it has to be very point blank, very obvious.
Do you have a team at GPL that does sit on expert testimony or witness or whatever for these litigation cases? Or is it more of the litigators taking that information and using it for the case?
I think a little bit of both happens. I know Dr. Shaw has gone and spoken to different trials as the expert in the testing and to be probably questioned on the mycotoxins. But what I've heard out in trials, a lot of times it's the lawyer doing the litigation. But I don't know if GPL has like a set team. I think it's more Dr. Shaw will go and speak.
Yeah.
What does somebody do if they're being made terribly ill by a building and yet the tests don't substantiate the level of their illness?
You mean from the mycotoxin perspective?
Yeah.
I think they'll go more on what they found in the environmental testing.
What about hypersensitive people who point at contaminated objects and it's probably not the building at all?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think it's terrible that they don't get the recognition, but it's really difficult to prove if you don't have those testing. And even if you do, like you say, even if they have a little bit of amount, but because of the genetic piece of the genetic makeup of the individual, in addition to the comorbidities they have or the sensitivities that they have, they are extremely sensitive to those few mycotoxins. How do you prove that?
Yeah, we're stuck. We've all been triggered into hypersensitivity and we've been unable to get out of this. And by getting extremely good at avoidance, we can lead normal appearing lives, but we're on the fringe of a paradigm that remains unexplained. We're on our own here.
Mm-hmm. I think the awareness is getting there. I remember being in the hospital in the NICU, and this is a small story, but every time we would put an infant in this one room, respiratory distress, problems with the lungs, we couldn't get them back. We'd have to, once we'd move them out of the room, they would normalize. Finally, the neonatologist that I was working under was, "We're closing off this room. You are not, nobody's allowed to transfer children into this room anymore. I don't want anybody in this room. There's got to be mold in there." And he shut it down and he went to the hospital. Yeah. And he was like, "There's mold in this. I don't care if you don't test it or not. We're not using this room anymore."
That's an incredible story. I remember years ago going to a chronic fatigue syndrome support group in a hospital down in Reno. And a nurse said that they had a room exactly like that. And they called it the sick baby room. They said any patient who was brought into this room had the worst prognosis, that no matter how what they had, it instantly turned into the worst case of whatever it was just by being in this room. And they had learned by experience not to put any really sick person in this one room because the outcome would be terrible. And then the nurse said, "But don't let anybody find out I told you this or I'll be fired."
Yeah. And, you know, another problem that is huge, but nobody's really talking about it out in the country is school. Our children are getting sick by going to their schools. And then even also the teachers. We have a ton of teachers that come through with mycotoxin testing that looks just awful. It was awful. And it's terrible because you're sending your children to these institutions and you're paying tax dollars to keep them open, and they can't afford to fix the roof, to fix the leak that's in the classroom.
Yeah, and people ask me, what is the way forward with mold illness? And they want to do testing. They want to test all the schools. They want to test every corner of every room in every school. And they want to pass laws. And I'm going, actually, there's a much easier way. we're the canaries. We're the people, the hypersensitives, who can tell you exactly where this is. All the authorities have to do is listen to us. If a sick person goes in and points to the corner of the room, that's when you know to take action. You don't have to test everything. There are plenty of people walking around who are fully capable of giving warning exactly where these toxins are.
Yeah. And that's what I tell patients when, you know, they come back and they're like, well, I'm just so sensitive. I'm like, but this is your superpower. You can now be the mold detector. And I think it's one of the silver linings.
It is, because if we act in accordance, if we have the leeway to be able to avoid mold to our own dictates, to our whatever level of reactivity that forces us to move away from it, we can lead very normal appearing lives. Yeah. So in a way, it's a blessing and a curse.
We have so much knowledge of this stuff. You have this knowledge that, like, oh, mold could be a really big issue, but then it becomes, you're almost paranoid. I know, like, when I go to my kids' school, I'll look around and I'll be like, oh boy, don't go over there. thank goodness they have, you know, air purifiers now in every room. But I what do you say? Hey, by the way, I think that's mold up there. You should probably do something about it. But we don't have the funds.
Yeah. And I'd like to send a message to any researchers, doctors, academics who happen to be listening to this, that the Center for Disease Control, the NIH, the top institutes are completely unaware of this phenomenon at this point. Or at least if they know about it, they're acting like they don't know about it. And what we really need is to put pressure on them to pay more attention, to learn about this, to study it, and connect the dots, because this has been going on for decades now. And we are completely on our own with this.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy stuff. We were literally on a call the other day with the EPA and the CDC. They were doing their annual indoor air quality reports, and we were specific about our questions. What are you guys doing about the rising toxic mold issue going around the U.S.? What are you guys doing about Stachybotrys? Are you looking into it? Well, their answers are just, they're non-answers, basically. Check our website. What's on your website? Nothing. But then they provide this information like, oh, we're doing this sophisticated testing and all this stuff. So this is very interesting. But you guys are saying you don't know anything about it or it's a non-issue, but you're also doing these covert testing with these top institutes. So it's revealing that maybe you do know something about it, but you just don't want to be public about it. And so that was really interesting. I'm actually curious to see if they'll even publish that recording with our questions, because we were very pervasive in that group with questioning. Anyways, I'm really curious with your knowledge with your like other competing labs that are doing mycotoxin testing. And one that comes to mind is My Myco Lab. How is GPL superior, or if it is superior to My Myco Lab, and what are your thoughts and opinions of that particular test?
That is My Myco Lab. I know Real Time and I know Vibrant, but My Myco Lab.
My Myco Lab is, they do blood serum antigen testing, IgE. Yeah.
IgE. Okay. I can tell you that mycotoxins are so small that our system doesn't necessarily produce immunoglobulins to them. Now, they do for the spores, but not the mycotoxins. So if that's the case, then the antibodies are coming from somewhere else. And then that would be more of like a lock and key methodology. I think if they're using immunoglobulins, they're using ELISA. Is that correct?
I believe so. They're using ELISA Act technology, yes.
Okay. Now IgE would be if they are having that histamine response when they get the mold at the spores. And then for IgG, I believe they do the same thing, but it's not histamine response, it's just inflammation. And it's
Right. How would you connect that to directly mold exposure, though? That's where it gets hairy.
Mm-hmm. All of the testing does have their pros and cons, but it would make sense to me to measure the actual toxin itself coming out in the urine than to try to do a lock and key method from an immune response. And I don't believe, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, if somebody wants to correct me, they can, but from my readings, our system does not produce an immune response to the mycotoxins themselves, but they're too small.
That's what Dr. Shoemaker was pointing out, that the innate immune response and not an antibody response means that we're dealing with some kind of chemical that isn't picked up by antibodies so much, or at least not reliably.
Yeah.
So yeah. Where do we go with this? If we don't have tests that can tell us about a non-antibody response, and we don't have tests that can reliably measure the amount of toxins in our body, what do we do with that?
I think that's where the urine test is really helpful. So what we're using is LC-MS, which is extremely specific. So we are looking for only that mycotoxin coming in the urine. And then you're able to assess how much is actually coming out of the body from the current exposure. Now, that doesn't help you if you had the exposure 10 years ago, but it will help you if you are currently being exposed.
So if you've got a lot of stored mycotoxins and aren't actively excreting, wouldn't that give you a false result?
So there is a lot of suspicion with that. And so there is a degree to where the body is holding on to these toxins, depending on the mycotoxin, that you don't usually start to see really high elevations until you start supporting the elimination of them. And I do see that from time to time. But if somebody is being currently exposed in very large amounts, I typically see them on the toxin panel.
Do you see a correlation between pre-treatment with glutathione to initiate detox and higher levels of measured excreted mycotoxins?
Yeah, good question. We've tried that in the laboratory to see if there was any difference. And it was so variable, we couldn't really say one way or the other. Sometimes it would, sometimes it wouldn't. But because of our methodology of the testing, what happens when you use glutathione is that when it conjugates to the mycotoxin, it changes the metabolite. So it's no longer mycophenolic acid. Now it's a new compound, MPAC, I think. And so when that gets eliminated, our test can't pick it up because our test is so specific. So generally speaking, we do not recommend taking glutathione prior to our testing, because if you're going to upregulate the excretion, they're going to conjugate to the glutathione, and then it changes and we can't pick it up in the urine.
Oh my God, it just gets more and more complicated.
I know. So what I usually tell people is, like, if you want to help stimulate that excretion, use sweating, get a massage, do a hot shower, hot bath to help release some of those toxins. And then you can see an influence in urine sometimes from that. But everybody's so different, right? Everybody's metabolism is different. Their ability to conjugate some of these mycotoxins with different compounds is gets very complicated. So I usually tell people, let's see what it comes out. That's your baseline. And if finances are available, recheck in 3 months and see what happens when you start supporting the body's own elimination. Sometimes you will see those numbers go up. It's almost like a bell-shaped curve. They'll jump up and then they'll come back down. And then that's how you know that you've gotten past that bioaccumulation.
Fantastic.
It's interesting that you mentioned you'll see progress within a patient within 6 months. And that's pretty aligned with Eric's progress when he first got sick and he practiced strict mold avoidance. It took him about 6 months from being completely bedridden and almost dying to climbing Mount Whitney. And so I'm wondering, if do you see in your patient population, are you seeing people recover quicker or long, or does it take longer compared to how much mycotoxins they have in their blood? I'm curious.
It's so variable. So ideally you should start to see improvement 3 to 6 months in initiation of treatment, just depending on how quickly you can get out of the environment, how much you can tolerate. But sometimes you just see it take longer, one, because patients can't get out of their home, or they can't fix it right away, or maybe they can't tolerate the intervention. And then the other thing that you're seeing in some people is that because of the immunosuppression is so severe and they've been in that environment for so long, they actually start to colonize. And you can see that on the organic acid test, and you can see it when they start using antifungals. And then they start the a lot quicker.
That's one thing I saw in the Stachybotrys exposures right away, is that people were coming down with Aspergillus infections that were shocking to doctors. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that the immune suppression of the Stachybotrys was enabling Aspergillus to get a foothold, whereas it otherwise wouldn't.
Exactly. And also, it changes the integrity of the intestinal lining, and it starts changing the microbiome. And when you have that, you're also going to be setting up for potential colonization, at least from the GI perspective. And then I think Mayo did a study where they looked at people coming in for that day for sinus surgery and culturing their sinuses, and finding a pretty significant amount of people were have had Aspergillus overgrowth in their sinuses.
Yeah, as far as the intestinal permeability, one of the most amazing things was within weeks of getting out, my food reactivities disappeared.
Yeah, because if you think about it, it's affecting the cellular membranes within the intestinal lining and the mucosal layer, and it can affect the tight junctions from that point.
in groups, we constantly people selling various diets and saying, oh, you've got to improve your diet, and people are doing everything they can to achieve the perfect diet. When after I got out, I went right back to beer and tacos, eating normal. I make no effort at all to avoid mold and food whatsoever, and I've never had to.
No. That's the thing. I mean, I did an article on our website for mycotoxins and food, and it's very minimal compared to what's going to happen if you are in a water damage building. So if you're in it and you're sick, yes, the dietary restrictions can certainly be helpful to reduce the inflammation and kind of help stop the burden to a degree. But that's not the main issue. And like you found, Eric, that once you improve, you don't have to do that anymore. Once the gut improves and you fix what's going on there, then a lot of those food reactivities improve pretty significantly. You see that a lot.
All right, I'll drink to that. my moldy coffee.
Just as long as it's not organic. So that's the other thing. People are like, oh, I'm trying to go mold-free in my food. And I hate saying this, but mycotoxins are more prevalent in organic food.
Oh.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, do you have lots of
data. Pardon?
Do you have that research?
Oh, yeah. It's in that blog.
Holy chmoles. That's mind-blowing.
It kind of makes sense if you think about it, right? Because they're not using as strong a fungicide.
That is true. That is very true. And we're coming up on the hour mark here. And Lindsay, it was just such a pleasure having you on. We never know who we're going to have on the show. We think that, oh, they might be good. And then they start saying some scary things and we're like, oh, nope. So wonderful. You've been so receptive, and just the knowledge and training that you have is so spot on. And we're very grateful just for what you're doing with GPL, and also for Great Plains, just for having something that exists, even though every test has its limitation. Nothing is a foolproof picture of anything, but at least it's maybe helping people win litigation, helping people validate possibly what's going on. I know when I was sick, I needed to do tests more to just validate that, man, yeah, I'm actually sick from this, or to show my husband, hey, look at this. This is what's going on. Believe me. If anything, it's like the tests are more of like a sociological thing, if anything. But again, I really do appreciate it. Now, I do know that with Great Plains, you might need to work with a doctor to order. Is there a way that people can order the test without a doctor's prescription or ordering through a doctor?
Well, there's a will, there's a way. You can go through MyMedLab, I think, is one of the websites. Lab Test Plus, that's plural. They also have both of those websites have physicians that will sign off on your test results. And I believe Ruba Health also has something in the works for that. That's another workaround for some patients if they can't get it through their physician.
Awesome. And if patients wanted to find you or work with you or ask questions specifically to you and your training and your knowledge, where can they find you?
Great Plains. So once I started consulting with Great Plains, I closed my practice. And so just for purposes. So just be Great Plains.
Hey, mold doctors and experts, I'm speaking to you. Do you have patients that no matter how hard you try, you just can't help them in the way that they need? Are you treating mold but seeing people stay sick or get worse? There may be some key points about toxic mold exposure that you are missing in your practice that patients need in order to support the best clinical outcomes possible. You can achieve superior outcomes by understanding the following: common failures of indoor mold testing and remediation, mold hypersensitivity, and residual contamination. If you struggle with any of these concepts in your practice, Exposing Mold is here to support you as you support your patients. We work with clinicians to help them understand the struggles of the hypersensitive mold injured population. If you feel like you're not helping people the way you want, let us help you help others. Visit exposingmold.com/consultations and book your appointment with us today.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We had a great conversation with Lindsay from Great Plains Lab. She is just a wealth of knowledge and really understands the limitations of testing and everything that's going on within the mold realm. Mold is still a major problem. If not, it's growing exponentially just day by day through communication with other people and what we see in these groups. So we definitely want to nip this in the bud. Please like, share, comment on our content. Check out our Patreon page, or we're offering a low-cost educational group. We also started sponsorships. So any businesses or practitioners, providers listening today, we are a tax-exempt corporation, or I don't know, foundation, I guess you can say. So you can go ahead and subscribe with us and become a corporate sponsor, or you can sign up to be an advertising agent where we can bring you on our podcast and advertise your services. Thank you again, everyone, and we'll see you next time.